A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's prompt this week is about Shu'afat refugee camp, and he frames it as a place that makes no sense in juxtaposition. It's inside the Jerusalem municipal boundary, but it's on the far side of the separation barrier. The city can't service it, the Palestinian Authority can't legally operate in it, and UNRWA, the one agency that did run things there, has been banned and dismantled. On top of that, it's a hotbed of militant activity. Daniel wants the history of how this no man's land came to be, and how Hamas can operate almost openly a few kilometers from downtown Jerusalem. Daniel's asking how this place came to exist, how it ended up in this jurisdictional hole, and how militant activity operates a few kilometers from downtown Jerusalem. That last part, the proximity, is what makes the whole thing feel like a trick of perspective.
The proximity is the part people get wrong. They hear refugee camp, and they picture something distant, somewhere out in the West Bank. Shu'afat is 3.5 kilometers from the old city. The sewage problem is the whole story in miniature, honestly. But start with the camp itself. UNRWA established Shu'afat camp in 1965 at the request of the Jordanian government.
And the walling off wasn't an accident of where the barrier happened to fall. The route was drawn in 2003, and the camp ended up on the West Bank side. That's the entire story in one sentence. The municipal line says Jerusalem. The barrier says otherwise. And the barrier is the thing that actually governs daily life.
Let me back up to how the camp got there in the first place, because the origin matters. UNRWA established Shu'afat camp in 1965, before the Six-Day War, when East Jerusalem was under Jordanian control. Right. Then 67 happens. Israel captures East Jerusalem, annexes it, redraws the municipal boundary to include Shu'afat and a whole ring of surrounding villages.
That's the detail that scrambles the usual narrative. People assume the camp is a post-1967 problem. It isn't. It was a Jordanian-era solution to overcrowding in the old city. Then 1967 happens. Israel annexes East Jerusalem, redraws the municipal boundary, and suddenly, this little camp is inside Israeli-declared territory.
And the residents were offered Israeli citizenship. Most refused. They took permanent residency instead. That's the status that governs their lives now. Permanent residency, not citizenship. It's revocable. The barrier is where the no man's land actually gets built. 2002 to 2005, Israel routes the separation fence through East Jerusalem. And here's the decision. Shu'afat camp plus the adjacent neighborhoods of Ras Khamis, Ras Shahada, and Dahayat al-Salam get left on the Palestinian side of the fence, outside the wall, but still inside the municipal boundary. But moving there put their residency status at risk, because Israel argues that living beyond the barrier means your center of life isn't really in Jerusalem. So the camp became a refuge for people who hold Jerusalem IDs but can't afford to live in Jerusalem proper. The overcrowding is a product of residency policy, not just poverty.
So the wall created a pressure cooker. People with Jerusalem IDs need to stay inside the municipal boundary to keep their status. The camp is inside the boundary. So they pile into the camp and the surrounding neighborhoods. Ras Khamis, Ras Shahada, Dahayat al-Salam. All dense high-rise construction packed against the camp. The actual UNRWA camp is tiny, 0.2 square kilometers. The surrounding area is what people usually mean when they say Shu'afat. That's the part that should make people pause. The wall wasn't built despite UNRWA being there. It was built partly because UNRWA was there. The international agency became the excuse for separation.
And now the agency is gone, so the excuse is gone, but the wall is still there. So what fills the gap? 50,000 people per square kilometer. That's denser than almost anywhere in the region. And the services never caught up. O'Shea did a report in 2016 that's still the clearest snapshot. Unpaved roads, no sidewalks, no street lighting. Water and sewage systems stretched past capacity. Garbage collection contracted out based on a population estimate that was far too low, so garbage gets burned regularly. You can smell it from the checkpoint.
And the city collects taxes from these residents. That's the part that should make people pause. They pay municipal taxes. The city's response to the service gap was a 2005 promise, something called the Jerusalem Envelope Community Authority. Schools, transport, services. A decade later, according to Akrai, none of it had materialized. The authority existed on paper.
The Palestinian Authority can't fill the gap. Oslo put Shuafat and Kafar Aqab inside the Israeli municipality, which means they're under full Israeli civil and military control. The PA is formally prohibited from operating there. So you have a place where the city won't go because it's beyond the barrier, and the PA can't go because the law says it's Israeli territory. Israeli police rarely enter except for security operations. Palestinian police can't enter at all. And yet they coexist, because the vacuum is big enough for both. 2016, six Shuafat residents arrested for founding an ISIS cell.
That's the thing Daniel's question gets at without quite naming it. The militancy isn't happening despite the vacuum. It's happening because of it. When neither authority polices a place, the people who do police it are the ones with guns and organization. Hamas and Islamic Jihad don't need to hide in Shuafat. They can hold public rallies. The drugs are the tell. Weapons and drugs together means the line between criminal and militant is blurry. The same smuggling networks move both. The same safe houses store both. Ideology and profit share the same infrastructure. The moment they try, they're occupying a camp inside their own municipal boundary, and the optics of that are catastrophic.
Walking through the streets. October 2022, a drive-by shooting at the Shuafat checkpoint kills an Israeli soldier. Israel besieges the camp for days during the manhunt, 60,000 people locked in. February 2023, a stabbing at the checkpoint kills a border police officer. March 2023, a shooting at the checkpoint wounds three soldiers, and Hamas and Islamic Jihad publicly bless it. That's not a hidden infrastructure, that's open support.
But here's where I want to be careful. Daniel's prompt says militant groups can almost openly operate there. The research supports public rallies, public blessings of attacks, public support marches. What it doesn't support is a standing Hamas command base with offices and a flag on a building. The openness is social and political. It's a place where Hamas can claim credit and get a crowd. That's different from an operational headquarters. And collective punishment radicalizes the population, which makes the camp more dangerous, which justifies more siege. It's a loop.
It's a loop with a history. And the history matters because Daniel asked for it. Let me walk it back properly. 1965, Jordan asks UNR way to build the camp. 1967, Israel captures and annexes East Jerusalem. The camp is now inside Israeli jurisdiction, but UNR way keeps operating because Israel allows it to. 1993, Oslo creates the Palestinian Authority, but the PA can't operate in Jerusalem. So UNR way remains the de facto service provider.
And now Israel is removing UNRWA, which was the one organization that did show up for services. Three schools, 638 students, one health center. That's what UNRWA ran in the camp. Sanitation collection, too. In April 2025, Israel shut down six UNRWA-affiliated schools in East Jerusalem. 800 children lost in-person teaching. Then the Knesset passed laws in late 2025, allowing disconnection of water, electricity, fuel, and communications from UNRWA facilities. December 2025, Israeli forces took over UNRWA's headquarters in Sheikh Jarrah. So the one agency that was actually doing the work gets banned. And the logic of the ban was that UNRWA perpetuates refugee status, that the agency's existence is what keeps Palestinians as refugees generation after generation.
Jamal Jumah from Stop the Wall put it plainly. UNRWA's presence is the physical representation of the refugee status of the population. Remove the agency, remove the status. That's the thesis. If there's no UNRWA, there's no recognition that these people are refugees. Both claims are on the record. They're unreconciled. And the High Court challenge to the UNRWA laws is still pending.
40 to 50% of the camp's population aren't registered refugees at all. They're just people who live there. What happens to them when the schools close? One school reopened under the Ministry of Education and the Jerusalem Municipality on August 22nd. Deputy Mayor Aryeh King posted video of UN Our Way signs being removed, so the replacement is happening. The question is whether the municipality will actually serve the population or just administer it.
That's the erasure thesis. Jamal Jumaya from Stop the Wall said it directly. UNRWA's presence is the physical representation of the refugee status of the population. If you remove UNRWA, you're not just changing who runs the schools. You're removing the institutional recognition that these people are refugees. That's the deeper fight. Netanyahu's statement was that Israel won't allow an organization whose employees were involved in terrorism to operate on its territory. The UN's response is that all UN premises are inviolable. But underneath both positions, there's a question about what happens to refugee status itself inside Jerusalem.
And the August 24th seizure of the Qalandia Training Center is the sharpest version of this. Ben-Gavir was there, on camera, saying, "Thank God, on my shift there's no UN Air Away. That's not a service transition. That's a political performance." So you have two completely incompatible stories about the same buildings. UNRWA says it's an illegal takeover of international agency property. The municipality says it's reclaiming private land from squatters. Both can't be true.
And both are true enough to their own legal frameworks. That's the whole problem with Shuafat. There's no shared framework. The camp exists in Israeli law as Jerusalem, in Palestinian law as occupied territory, in UNRWA's framework as a refugee camp, and in practice as a place where none of those frameworks actually govern. Everywhere else, UNRWA operates in the West Bank or Gaza or Lebanon or Syria. Shuafat is the one place where the camp is inside Israeli declared territory, so the fight over UNRWA in Jerusalem is really a fight over Shuafat.
Let me put the whole thing in one frame. In 1965, Jordan and UNRWA created a camp to house refugees from the Old City. In 1967, Israel annexed the land around it. In 2003, Israel walled it off. In 2024, Israel banned the agency that ran it. In 2026, Israel is physically removing that agency. Each step is a decision made by a different authority with a different rationale. 2 days ago. So this isn't a historical curiosity. It's an active front. The camp is under Israeli military operation right now. Hamas is threatening retaliation, and the sewage still isn't running.
And the Hamas statement is worth reading carefully. It says, "Jerusalem, its towns and refugee camps, will remain entirely Palestinian." It accuses Israel of trying to isolate it, Judaize it, and impose control over it. That's not a statement about sewage. That's a claim of ownership over the camp as Palestinian territory. That's not a failure of enforcement. That's the structure working as designed.
The camp is now more Palestinian in its self-conception, not less. Hamas isn't claiming Shuafat because UNRWA left. It's claiming Shuafat because the vacuum makes it possible. The Oslo carve-outs were negotiated under time pressure. The UNRWA ban is ideological. These are separate decisions that produced a coherent outcome anyway. The outcome is a place that belongs to everyone and no one.
Criminal gangs, militant cells, and 100,000 people trying to live normal lives in the middle of it. So if you have a heart attack in Shuafat, you wait. The checkpoint is where the two Jerusalems meet, and it's where the friction is most visible. Most of the attacks we mentioned happened at or near that checkpoint. It's the symbol and the target.
That's political solidarity. But political solidarity doesn't fix a broken sewage pipe. If you stop crossing because you can't afford the commute or the checkpoint gets too dangerous, your residency is at risk. So people keep crossing even when it's dangerous. The checkpoint isn't just infrastructure. A flag with a school bell.
The municipality's position is that it wants to provide services. It says the properties are private and it has usage agreements. It says it intends to open educational institutions. But the track record is that every previous attempt to provide services collapsed because the security situation made it impossible. So either the security situation changes or the services don't happen. But it's not the same as Hamas controlling the camp.
That's an important correction. The camp isn't a Hamas stronghold in the way some Israeli coverage frames it. It's a place where Hamas has support, because Hamas is the most visible opponent of the status quo. If the status quo changed, if services improved, if the checkpoint eased, that support might not disappear, but it'd have less to feed on. The security problem is downstream of the governance problem.
And the governance problem is downstream of the legal problem. The legal problem is that Israel annexed East Jerusalem but never resolved the status of the people who lived there. Permanent residency without citizenship. And families do stay. The camp is incredibly dense. The official area is 0.2 square kilometers. That's about 50 acres. UNRWA registered 16,000 refugees there. Other estimates put the actual population much higher. The 2022 siege estimated 60,000 residents in the camp area.
50 acres? That's smaller than a lot of college campuses. 60,000 people on 50 acres. The result is irrational as a whole. That's what makes it hard to explain and harder to fix. You can't undo one layer without disturbing the others.
That's why Israeli forces can't just arrest a few people. Any operation touches thousands of families. The health center is the same question. Who staffs it? Who funds it? The municipality says it has a usage agreement with private owners. But private owners don't run schools. The municipality will have to run them. I don't know how you break that loop. I don't. The people who designed the barrier in 2002 probably thought they were buying security. What they bought was a permanent insurgency on the other side of the wall.
It did, in the sense that attacks from the West Bank dropped, but it concentrated the problem into a few dense enclaves that are now worse than the diffuse problem ever was. The difference is that this time, the takeover is happening. The signs are coming down. The locks are being broken. So something is actually being done. Whether what's being done is service provision or political erasure is the open question.
An ISIS cell, Hamas financing, weapons smuggling, all in a place where no police force can operate normally. Those are UNRWA's figures, so they're advocacy numbers, but they're specific. 3 schools, 638 students. The scale is small enough that the municipality could theoretically absorb it. The question is whether it will.
The Kalandia seizure suggests the answer. That training center served 340 Palestinians a year. It's now under Israeli control. Ben-Gavir's video is the clearest statement of intent. This isn't about improving services. It's about removing UNRWA. The services are collateral.
And the refugee status question is the deepest layer. UNRWA's presence is the physical representation of refugee status. If UNRWA is gone from Shuafat, what happens to the 16,000 registered refugees? The extreme edge is where you see the contradictions most clearly. A resident of Shuafat can vote in Jerusalem municipal elections, but they can't get a building permit from the municipality. They pay some taxes but receive no services. They're inside the boundary but outside the wall. Every category is half applied.
Half applied categories are the worst kind. Full exclusion is at least coherent. Full inclusion is coherent. Half inclusion means nobody knows what the rules are, so whoever has the most guns makes the rules. So the refugee status has to go. UNRWA has to go. The camp has to become just a neighborhood. That's the project.
And the project is running into the fact that the camp isn't just a neighborhood. It's a place with its own history, its own politics, its own armed factions. You can remove UNRWA. You can't remove the camp's identity. Which is why the sewage appeal matters so much. It's not just about sewage. It's about whether any legitimate authority will step into the vacuum. If the municipality fixes the sewage, that's a claim of governance.
Where does this leave Daniel's question about militant activity? I think it leaves us with an uncomfortable conclusion. The militancy is a product of the structure. The structure is a product of unresolved legal questions. And if it's on its own, Hamas will be happy to claim it. The Hamas statement from 2 days ago is essentially an announcement that the camp is under its protection. Full separation means redrawing the municipal boundary and accepting that the annexation doesn't cover this population. Neither is politically possible right now.
The vacuum persists. UNRWA is removed. The municipality makes promises. The PA stays barred. The police stay out except for raids. Hamas holds rallies. The checkpoint stays crowded. The garbage keeps burning. That's the equilibrium. And the wall is visible from the camp. You can see Jerusalem from Shuafat. You can see the city you're technically part of, but can't enter without a permit. That's a specific kind of psychological pressure.
The proximity is the point. Daniel said a few kilometers from downtown Jerusalem. That's not an exaggeration. The camp is close enough that the contrast is inescapable. The question is whether the municipality becomes a real actor or just a new sign on the same broken buildings.
638 students.
The municipality says it wants to. The PA says it can't. UNR Way is gone. The gangs and militants are there.
The municipality is talking about opening educational institutions. In 1984, I did a 6-month contract with the Jerusalem municipality, facilities assessment for schools in East Jerusalem. The report said the municipality was already underserving the neighborhoods inside the barrier. Shuafat wasn't even on the list. It was considered outside the service area. The report sat on a shelf. I saw it in a deputy mayor's office in 2009, same binder, same coffee stain.
The pattern of promising and not delivering predates the barrier.
The barrier just gave it a physical form. Before the wall, the city ignored Shuafat because it was a refugee camp and the camp was UNRWA's problem. After the wall, the city ignored it because it was on the wrong side. The reason changed. The ignoring didn't.
That's the continuity I keep missing when I focus on the legal shifts. The legal status changed in 1967, 1994, 2003, 2024. The service level didn't change at all. It was always minimal.
There's a man named Abu Khalil. He ran a small grocery in the camp near the school. I met him in 1984. He said the camp had been waiting 20 years for a sewage connection. When I went back in 2009, his son was running the same grocery. They were still waiting. 5 years after that, O'Shea documented the sewage problem as current. That's 50 years of waiting for a pipe.
Exactly what the residents will resist, which means the schools, if they open, will be targets. For militants, for protests, for boycotts.
The pipe is the story they don't tell. Everyone wants to talk about Hamas and checkpoints and UNR Way. The pipe is boring. But the pipe is why Hamas can hold a rally. You wait 50 years for a pipe, and somebody shows up and says, the reason you're waiting is that the people on the other side of the wall don't want you to have it. You listen. Maybe you don't join. But you listen.
The UNRWA removal feeds that narrative directly. The one organization that was providing something, even inadequate, is being taken away by the same authority that never connected the pipe. The message is coherent. The residents are stuck choosing between a municipality that can't serve them and a militant movement that can't govern them. That's not a choice. That's a trap.
The trap is the point. Shuafat is what happens when you design a place to be ungovernable and then act surprised when it becomes ungoverned. These are concrete failures that have persisted for decades. Removing UNRWA doesn't address any of them. It adds a new one.
The municipality's usage agreement with private owners. I'd like to see that agreement. In 1984, the municipality couldn't get a usage agreement for a parking lot in Beit Hanina. Now it's signing agreements for school compounds in Shuafat. Either the legal department got much better, or the agreement is thin.
The municipality says the properties are privately owned and UNRWA occupied them unlawfully. UNRWA says Jordanian custodianship and UN immunity. Both can't be true. The High Court will sort it eventually, but by the time it does, the schools will have been operating under the municipality for a year. The facts on the ground will be established.
Pipes from the 60s, never upgraded. UNRWA patched it. That's all they ever did, patch it. Because the municipality wouldn't touch it, and the Jordanians before that hadn't built it to last. Different scale!
The one thing I take from this is that Shuafat doesn't make sense because it was never supposed to. It's the product of decisions that each made sense locally and produced nonsense globally. Jordan moved refugees out of the old city. Israel annexed the land. The barrier planners drew a line. The Knesset banned UNRWA. Each step was defensible on its own terms. The result is a place where nobody governs and everybody claims to.
The sharpening sentence is this. The militancy isn't the anomaly. The militancy is what a place looks like when the pipe never gets connected and the only organization that shows up with a plan is the one with guns. That's the thing to remember.
The open question is whether the municipality's takeover changes anything on the ground or just changes the signs on the buildings. We'll see that in the next year. If the schools actually run, if the health center actually opens, if the garbage actually gets collected, then something real has shifted. If not, it's the same place with different letterhead.
The High Court ruling on the UNRWA laws is the thing to watch. It's pending. If the court strikes down the enforcement powers, the physical takeovers get harder to complete. If it upholds them, the campaign continues. Either way, the pipe is still not connected.
The security response is literally destroying the physical plant of the camp. Not as a policy, but as a side effect.
Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.